Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Masterclass meeting tonight, Thursday night, October 26th, 2023. I thank everybody for joining. We do have a long list of presenters tonight, so I do want to get off. I'm going to get started as soon as possible. And Larissa is first, if you are ready.
I am ready. I will start sharing. Sorry. Can you see that yet or not yet?
Yes, I do see it.
Yes.
Is it in presenter mode or not? I just can't see necessarily what you see.
No,
It's not.
I see it in the PowerPoint mode.
Okay.
There we go.
Is that right now? Okay.
Yep.
Yep. Cool. Okay. Good evening, everyone. I'm Larissa Vinciguerra. Tonight, I'll discuss facial recognition technology, which has gained remarkable prominence in recent years. We will explore its extensive use cases, advantages, disadvantages, biases, controversies, and ethical implications. Our goal is to comprehensively understand its far-reaching impact, empowering us to make informed decisions about its use. Although most of us already are familiar with what it is, since we use it every day, let's start anyway by defining what facial recognition technology truly is. Facial recognition technology is a biometric system that identifies individuals by analyzing and comparing their unique facial features. It operates by capturing and processing facial images or video frames, converting these features into mathematical representations known as facial templates, and then using AI algorithms to make comparisons. Facial recognition technology has revolutionized several sectors. Notably, it has become a game changer in law enforcement and security. By enabling real-time comparisons to vast databases, it aids in identification of criminals, missing individuals, and potential threats, contributing to crime prevention and public safety. However, beyond security, the application of facial recognition are far-reaching. It's woven into the fabric of our daily lives, from unlocking smartphones to enhancing user experiences in smart devices. Additionally, it offers benefits in fields like banking, education, and even retail. For example, security systems commonly use identity verification to grant or deny access to a facility, device, or digital account based on facial authentication. Law enforcement agencies and security organizations use facial recognition to monitor crowds, track individuals, and identify potential threats in public spaces. Moreover, many modern smartphones and computers use facial recognition as a security method for unlocking devices and authorizing access to apps and data. Retailers and marketers use it to analyze customer demographics and behavior for targeted advertising and customer experience improvement. Additionally, education institutions and businesses can automate attendance records using facial recognition to streamline processes. Social media platforms also leverage it to automatically tag people in photos and enhance photo organization and sharing. Now here's where we tread to the delicate balance. Is facial recognition technology inherently good or bad? The answer is not as straightforward as we might wish. Like many technologies, its ethical implications are deeply intertwined with how it's used and who uses it. Let's focus on facial recognition's benefits in our digital age. In a world where innovation has become the norm, facial recognition stands at the forefront of ensuring our safety and security. Law enforcement agencies have harnessed its powers to swiftly apprehend criminals and locate missing individuals. Recent examples highlight its remarkable effectiveness, such as the rapid capture of an accused rapist in New York within 24 hours of the crime. Furthermore, the expansion of facial recognition at airports promises to bolster security, deterring criminal activity. After all, individuals are less likely to commit crimes when they know they're under watchful eyes of this technology. But it's not just about security. Facial recognition offers a seamless and contactless approach to our daily lives, eliminating the need for physical keys or identification cards. Imagine the convenience of streamlined store checkout processes or the effective service at establishments like an AI bar, where your presence alone can be enough to recall your favorite drinks. And yes, I read several articles about AI bars. I don't need one of those, though. Additionally, it provides robust anti-fraud capabilities, safeguarding our financial interests. These are just a few of our facial recognition's vast benefits to our modern world, enhancing security and convenience. While facial recognition technology shows great promise, it also raises significant concerns that demand careful consideration. Chief among these concerns is the encroachment on our fundamental right to privacy. The technology's intrusive nature enables constant surveillance of individuals in both public and private domains, prompting a profound debate over eroding our privacy. Another concern arises from the technology's inherent inaccuracies, particularly in recognizing diverse faces, leading to biases and potential injustices. It's a pressing issue that disproportionately affects marginalized communities and raises ethical questions about fairness and discrimination. Equally important is the lack of robust regulations and oversight. The absence of clear guidelines can pave the way for potential misuse by both government and private entities. This can result in unwarranted monitoring, challenging our civil liberties and the delicate balance between security and individual freedoms. The controversies surrounding facial recognition force us to grapple with the complex questions about the interplay between its potential benefits and security and convenience and the risks of overreach and harm to personal freedoms. For several years, the TSA has implemented facial recognition as part of its security measures at airports across the United States. Currently, 238 airports use biometric facial comparison technology in air entry environment. This technology involves capturing and analyzing passengers' facial images to verify their identity and, in theory, enhance airport security. However, as with any technological advancement, it has sparked significant debate and raised important privacy concerns. First and foremost, the TSA argues that facial recognition technology offers the potential for enhanced security. Accurately identifying individuals and cross-referencing their information with watch lists and databases of known threats can help identify potential risks and prevent unauthorized access to secure areas. In essence, it aims to make our airports safer by identifying individuals of interest swiftly. Proponents of this technology also highlight its potential to streamline passenger screening. Imagine a world where you can move through security checkpoints more efficiently and with fewer intrusions. Facial recognition promises to expedite this process, which could reduce lines and wait times, making travel experiences more pleasant and less stressful. One particularly intriguing aspect of facial recognition is the prospect of biometric boarding passes. Advocates believe replacing traditional boarding passes and identification documents with facial recognition could reduce the chances of identity theft and document fraud. It could create a more seamless and secure travel experience for us all. However, it's essential to recognize the other side of this debate, which centers on privacy concerns. Critics argue that collecting and storing biometric data on travelers can be invasive and pose significant risks, especially if that data falls into the wrong hands. The concerns about data security and potential misuse are paramount. Moreover, facial recognition technology is not infallible and can lead to false positives or negatives. Errors can result in innocent passengers facing unnecessary delays or worse, being wrongly flagged as potential threats. Such inaccuracies have the potential to create frustrating and distressing situations during our travels. Critics also raise concerns about the lack of consent. Passengers may not always be adequately informed or given the choice to opt out of facial recognition, leading to worries about surveillance without consent. This touches on fundamental issues related to the individual freedoms and personal privacy. One of the most significant concerns about the TSA's use of facial recognition is the potential for mission creep. What may begin as a tool for verifying the identity of passengers at security checkpoints could expand into broader surveillance, tracking individuals throughout the airport or even in public spaces. This brings us face-to-face with the balance between security and our civil liberties. To add another layer to the conversation, the absence of comprehensive federal regulations governing the use of facial recognition in transportation security has fueled concerns. Advocates for privacy have called for stricter oversight and regulation to protect travelers' rights and maintain a delicate equilibrium between security and personal freedom. The TSA's use of facial recognition represents a fascinating yet complex chapter in the evolution of airport security. While it promises enhanced security and efficiency, we must be vigilant in addressing the pressing concerns surrounding privacy, accuracy, consent, and mission creep. As we move forward, we must carefully consider the future of this technology and the regulatory frameworks that can protect our rights while keeping us safe in the skies. The ethical concerns surrounding facial recognition are multifaceted and substantial. They encompass both privacy and surveillance, data security, ethical dilemmas, and the issues of racial and social bias. Facial recognition can potentially infringe on personal privacy by enabling ubiquitous surveillance. This pervasive surveillance introduced the risks of unwanted monitoring and unauthorized data collection, causing individuals to feel as if their every move is under scrutiny. Consequently, it erodes their sense of personal freedom. Another critical issue is the security of the biometric data. The vulnerability of this data to cyber attacks and hacking highlights the potential for severe consequences, including identity theft and the misuse of personal information. Protecting the security of the data is not just a priority, but an ethical imperative. Furthermore, facial recognition technology presents policymakers and stakeholders with intricate ethical dilemmas. These dilemmas encompass FRT's responsible and ethical use, particularly in the context like mass surveillance. Striking a balance between fulfilling security needs and upholding individual rights is a formidable challenge. Lastly, the issue of racial and social bias in facial recognition looms large. Bias is particularly evident in the technology across different racial and demographic groups. These disparities give rise to pressing ethical concerns related to fairness, discrimination, and the potential for misuse, as certain groups may bear a disproportionate burden of these biases. Given the ethical concerns, there's a compelling need for improved policies and guidelines regarding facial recognition. These guidelines encompass various key aspects. First, data protection is paramount. Comprehensive policies are necessary to safeguard biometric data, ensuring it remains protected from unauthorized access and is handled responsibly. These policies also should dictate how data is collected, stored, and used, emphasizing obtaining consent and transparency. Transparency and accountability must be prioritized by policymakers, requiring organizations to disclose how and when facial recognition is deployed. This involves establishing mechanisms for accountability and oversight, providing clear information to the public. Furthermore, guidelines should explicitly address FRT's fair and ethical use, setting clear limitations, especially in the context like mass surveillance. These ethical standards ensure that the technology respects the rights and dignity of individuals. To address bias, policymakers should incorporate provisions for bias mitigation in facial recognition systems, promoting the development of accurate and fair technology, and thereby minimizing the potential for discrimination. Finally, international collaboration is crucial. Given the cross-border nature of facial recognition technology, countries should work together to harmonize regulations, share best practices, and develop global ethical standards to ensure this technology is consistent, responsible, and secure use. This approach creates a framework that effectively balances security with individual rights and values. In conclusion, facial recognition technology is a powerful tool with significant benefits and concerns. Its impact depends on how we use it and the rules we set. We must prioritize data protection, transparency, bias mitigation, and international collaboration. As we navigate this landscape, we're responsible for ensuring that innovation does not compromise our fundamental rights and freedoms. Thank you all for your time and attention. Oh, also here are my references. My little note on the bottom there was what made me think about facial recognition to be my topic. And that was watching Class of 09, which is a show on Hulu, and the other show, Black Mirror. That one had an episode that was all about like social standards that you would get judged all over the place wherever you went. And it reminded me of this.
That was really good. And I'm really into the fact that I don't like the fact that TSA wants to use.
Yeah, I'm with you.
You know, I just
it's a little scary to have it out there everywhere, not just in our own, like just for ourselves, which is kind of what really sparked my interest in reading more about this.
Yeah, it brings
We just use retina scanners then. It's that's even more accurate.
No. Sure.
Yeah.
No. I don't want that.
Yeah, I know. If you watch like the show Class of 09 and how like deeply they're like watching everybody, it like really made me start thinking about this so much. Because it's the world we're kind of headed towards, and I don't really want that world.
I saw the one in Black Mirror, so I totally know what you're saying.
Oh, you did see that? See?
Yeah.
That's another one. Nosedive is the episode. It's an interesting one.
Yeah, I didn't like that.
Yeah, me either. You could have one bad day, and it ruins everything.
Exactly. And it's, because... the data is out there. Everything's out there. And I hate the fact that we're just like, we're coming to the point where everything is going to be dependent on that.
Yeah, I know.
It reminds me, I don't know if anybody's ever seen the movie Total Recall.
Yeah.
The original or the remake?
Yes.
The original. Where he goes through the airplane thing and it scans his whole body. You can see his skeleton. Yeah. And he changes his facial features and everything to get through. And it's just, it's too much.
Yeah.
Exactly. Jameson has a question.
We'll be able to do it like that. Go ahead.
I got a question for Larissa. Just wondering, with your, in your research, did it mention anything about issues with like identical twins or the fact that everybody has a doppelganger and there could be those false positive type situations?
Right.
Well, I think that's kind of, I honestly did not come across it, but now that you say it, I'm going to go look it up. But I feel like that's part of one of the major issues is that like the whole like bias, you know, that can come along with it. I think that's part of the problem.
Outside of Caucasians, the accuracy drops significantly.
Tremendously. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I feel like I've heard like in China with their social credit system, social score, that they've had people be like falsely flagged or charged with crimes or whatever they didn't commit, like jaywalking or whatever, you know?
Yeah. Right. Well, that's some of the stuff I came across, actually. Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Dr. Moore.
No, I was going to say, because you're absolutely right, because it's based upon your skull structure.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the forensic scientists who can take a skull and reconstruct a face. I mean, this is what this is based on. And there are racial differences in how much variance is involved in your facial structure, which is why I said, let's just do the eye retina scans.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, and Larissa, you're going to need to focus in on the type 2 errors there. Okay. The false positives.
Yeah.
You're in analytics. So let's be analytical about this.
Right.
I know. Well, I started to get really interested in AI over the past couple months because I was training. I was training a large language model before I had to leave that job so I could focus better on school. So
all these kinds of things now are have been very intriguing, and I need to continue my research.
Yeah. I can just see how it can be scary, and I think it's just it depending too much on technology and AI to do the work.
Yeah, I have a little bit of a fear of AI, which is why I think I'm so interested in it, because I do think that if it's not truly regulated and really carefully used, it can turn dangerous.
Yeah. And I think as we get lazier and lazier as a society, we keep expecting things to work for us. And that's where technology gets in the way.
Oh, yeah, most definitely.
Well, that was excellent.
Thank you.
Justin says he is ready. Baby's down.
Yeah, she finally went to sleep.
Aw.
She's teething, so it's kind of hit or miss. Oh, yeah,
that's for sure.
Yeah. So do I just hit share, right? I've never.
Yes, you just go on to share. And if you've got anything that's going to that you need us to hear other than yourself, toggle the. What's it called? Include computer sound.
OK.
Yep, I see your screen.
OK. And it's in presentation mode.
Yes.
All right, cool. All right. Welcome, everyone, to this presentation titled Unmasking Cyber Threats, the Power of OSINT and Cybersecurity, and the Enigma of Sock Puppet Accounts. That is that's quite the title. Let's see if the presentation can live up to the name. We will be discussing the role of open source intelligence, or OSINT, in the world of cybersecurity. Today, we will also touch on how OSINT has become an invaluable tool for security professionals. But first, let's understand what OSINT really is. So first off, hello, everyone. My name is Justin Hicks. I am currently pursuing or about to finish my associate in information technology, concentrating in cybersecurity. I have always had an interest in the world of cybersecurity, and one day I just decided that it is what I wanted to pursue for my education and as a career. Last year, I really started becoming passionate about open source intelligence and how it plays such a vital role, good and bad, in our current technological world. In the fast-paced world of cybersecurity, information is power. The ability to gather, analyze, and act upon open source information is a skill that we can make all that can make all the difference. OSINT can provide a wealth of knowledge, but it also presents its own set of challenges. Today, we'll explore this dynamic landscape and understand why OSINT is a critical component of modern cybersecurity. Let's begin with the basics. Open source intelligence, or OSINT, is the practice of collecting information from publicly available sources on the internet. This includes data from websites, social media, search engines, public databases, and more. It's like having a treasure trove of information right at your fingertips. In recent years, OSINT has significantly expanded its role. Today, it's not just the domain of intelligence agencies. With the growth of the internet, social media, and advanced technology, OSINT is now a critical component in various fields. It's used in cybersecurity, law enforcement, business intelligence, journalism, and even in finding missing persons. The expansion is a testament to the power and versatility of OSINT. We'll dive deeper into how OSINT is applied in these diverse areas in the coming slides. Open source intelligence originated from military and government intelligence, primarily relying on publicly available sources. Its historical significance can be tracked back to World War II, when information was gathered from newspapers and radio broadcasts. With the advent of the digital era, OSINT has evolved into a sophisticated discipline, embracing the vast landscape of the internet and technology. Today, OSINT encompasses an extensive range of sources reflecting its growing importance in modern cybersecurity. I find it interesting how both of these pictures kind of look the same, and they're from different time periods. OSINT isn't just for the curious, it's a powerful tool for cybersecurity professionals. It goes beyond traditional methods, allowing us to uncover digital footprints and gather critical insights that can't be obtained through standard security measures. Some of the examples of using OSINT for cybersecurity would be penetration testing, reconnaissance, and data gathering. So how do we harness the power of OSINT? We have a variety of techniques at our disposal, such as search engines, social media analysis, exploring online forums, accessing public databases, and much more. It's like assembling a toolkit for uncovering hidden information. Let's take a closer look at some modern OSINT tools and enhance our capabilities. Multigo is a powerful data mining and link analysis tool invaluable for tracking online footprints. The Harvester is a tool for gathering emails, subdomains, and virtual hosts, often used to learn about a target's online presence. Google Maps is a versatile tool for geolocation and mapping, enabling us to pinpoint physical locations associated with online data. Exif tool helps extract metadata from files, providing insights into their origins and history. And Joplin serves as a customizable note-taking and to-do list app, assisting in managing findings and creating structured reports. These tools, combined with traditional techniques, offer a comprehensive approach to OSINT, allowing us to uncover valuable insights while respecting ethical boundaries. Now let's explore the ethical side of OSINT. Ethical hackers utilize OSINT to discover digital footprints, support penetration testing, and enhance threat intelligence. It's about understanding the adversary's perspective to bolster the defenses. For example, ethical hackers often use a technique called Google dorking that involves crafting specific search queries on Google to reveal sensitive information or potential vulnerabilities that might be publicly accessible. Google dorking can unveil things like exposed directories, login pages, or even confidential documents. Another valuable OSINT tool or OSINT resource is checkusernames.com, a website where you can check usernames across various platforms. This allows ethical hackers to determine if a specific username is in use on social media, forums, or other online spaces. This information can be vital for assessing a target's online presence and potential attack vectors. Ethical hacking with OSINT not only helps secure systems, but also provides insight into how cyber criminals might exploit vulnerabilities. But with any tool, OSINT has its darker applications. Malicious actors use OSINT to gather information about their targets. This can lead to identifying vulnerabilities or creating a roadmap for a cyber attack. It's a reminder that we must be vigilant in safeguarding sensitive information. To see OSINT in action, let's examine a real-life example, the identification of Capitol rioters during the January 6th insurrection. OSINT played a pivotal role in the investigation, underpinning what has been described as the largest criminal investigation in U.S. history. In the 2 years following the attack, more than 940 individuals have been identified and charged in connection with the events of that day. This case offers a comprehensive illustration of the multifaceted digital footprint on January 6th and how open source intelligence was instrumental in understanding the lead up to the attack and in identifying the rioters. Law enforcement, Congress, journalists, and various researchers harness publicly available evidence sources to achieve these goals. Citizens, often referred to as sedition hunters, have played an invaluable role in this massive undertaking. These dedicated individuals, motivated by a profound sense of civic duty, have combed through the vast online landscape, assisting in the identification of suspects involved in the January 6th insurrection. OSINT has empowered ordinary citizens to contribute significantly to the complex investigation. Their efforts underline the critical role of OSINT in upholding accountability and justice in the digital age. Now let's dive into another intriguing aspect of OSINT, sock puppets, and not these sock puppets. These are social personas created for intelligence gathering. They play a crucial role in OSINT investigations, providing a disguise to gather information. When it comes to crafting effective sock puppets for online anonymity and persona management, you'll need a set of essential tools and strategies. Here's how to create and maintain sock puppets effectively: a secure email generator, like Proton Mail or DuckDuckGo to create a fictitious email account that are not linked to your real identity. This email will be essential for managing your sock puppet personas. Consider using a burner phone or a service like Google Voice to acquire an anonymous phone number. This phone number can be associated with your sock puppet personas for added credibility. It can also help keep away spam calls. And employ a VPN to mask your IP address and maintain online anonymity. A VPN helps protect your true location and identity while managing your sock puppets. By combining these tools with a strategic approach to online behavior, you can create and effectively manage sock puppets for various purposes while safeguarding your identity. Open source intelligence is a powerful yet dual-edged tool in the world of cybersecurity. When harnessed for ethical purposes, it empowers professionals to bolster defenses, discover vulnerabilities, and enhance threat intelligence. Ethical hackers use OSINT for penetration testing, ensuring systems remain secure against potential threats. However, the same OSINT techniques can be employed by malicious actors to gather information about targets, exploit vulnerabilities, and plan cyber attacks. Its misuse can lead to online harassment, identity theft, and data breaches, emphasizing the need for a clear understanding of its dual nature. And OSINT evolves in the digital landscape, responsible and ethical use is essential to protect individuals and organizations against potential threats. In conclusion, OSINT is a potent cybersecurity tool enhancing information gathering and security measures. However, the ever-growing number of internet and social media users, with projected increase to 5.85 billion users by 2027, highlights the potential for a surge in sock puppet accounts and necessitates a stronger focus on understanding, learning, and defending against malicious actors in the digital landscape. This quote highlights the internet's power to enable different personas and behaviors due to anonymity, emphasizing the duality of online conduct and the need for responsible digital ethics. It also serves as a reminder of the duality of online behavior, where the absence of real-life accountability can lead to both positive and negative consequences, highlighting the importance of responsible online conduct and digital ethics. Thank you.
Amazing. I hadn't thought about that. Of course, I didn't think about hacking something either, but
this is worse than facial recognition.
Yeah, because you're totally faking everything about it.
You can manipulate this so much, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's it gets kind of scary. Because I had to do a mock investigation into somebody, and the stuff that I was able to find out about that person was ridiculous, just using some of the OSINT techniques and Google dorking. I was able to find out their address, geolocation, find out what cards they own, FAA license, all sorts of stuff was on the internet. And this is a very well-known figure, somebody who's in the billionaires club. And just the fact that they had all their information out there was, and they probably have a team that kind of protects that, was pretty scary. So, and the fact that you can just do things without any kind of consequence online is pretty terrifying as well.
Yeah. And if they can find you, that's the thing too.
Yeah.
Well, excellent. Excellent job. I tell you, that is, y'all are just scaring me today. All right.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, we are coming up on Halloween. Is this the Halloween edition?
I know. Here we go. That's it. Eric, are you ready? Oh, I don't see him here. Eric Jost. Set him aside. Is this, is Eric, oh, I think he's sick. Hold on, I'll grab it. It's soft. Okay, I thought so. Rick. I don't see his presentation. All right, let's move on to, I'll see what I can find. Let's move on to Aman. Are you ready?
I am. Let me see how to do this. Sure. Is this good to go?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Good evening, everyone. My name is Aman Avani, and this is Impact of Emerging Technologies on Cybersecurity. To begin, it's important to consider where technology was, where it is today, and where it will be in the future. In the past, we have seen the development of the internet, the introduction of cell phones, and advancements in cloud computing. In present times, we are exploring new AI/ML techniques, IoT, and blockchain. Given how the world is progressing, we can expect to see vast improvements in bio-integrated technology and quantum computing in the near future. It is extremely important to note that with the introduction of these new technologies, new threat vectors also come to light, which in turn steer us to define and implement proper countermeasures to prevent ease of access to privileged information. As all of us know, the vast realm of cybersecurity is ever-growing, directly alongside the need for more information needing to be kept secure. The rise of new technology, despite how many may find it beneficial, is also paving the way for many more potential security issues. Even advancements such as AI can lead to inadvertent consequences by making phishing emails much more realistic. Lastly, the Internet of Things essentially means a network of devices that are all interconnected using sensors or other communication devices, and these devices can all speak to one another. Sorry, here's someone's mic. Okay, it's fine. Okay, these devices can all communicate with another and also communicate with the cloud. As you can probably tell, there are numerous cybersecurity issues that come alongside this, which will be explained later in this presentation. People often confuse artificial intelligence and machine learning and tend to use them interchangeably. Although the two are very interconnected, they both are different when it comes to technicalities. Artificial intelligence, as you can see from the diagram to the right, is defined as a program that can sense, reason, act, and adapt, which essentially mimics human behavior. Machine learning is a subset of artificial intelligence and refers to programs that are developed using past data to revise and fine-tune their algorithms. With these new emerging technologies, cyber attacks are easier than ever. New artificial intelligence and machine learning programs can sift over failed hacking attempts and rework the flaws in the attack to launch one successfully. Similarly, phishing attempts have become a lot more prevalent due to the rise of AI. Artificial intelligence can make phishing emails seem almost entirely legitimate, which can easily fool any victims. Lastly, the introduction of AI and machine learning is allowing malware to be instantaneously created and spread. Viruses, Trojans, and other malware are being revised and made more effective as advancements in AI and machine learning take place. Although artificial intelligence and machine learning have introduced numerous ways in which a victim can be compromised, they have also allowed for advancements in defense mechanisms. Artificial intelligence and machine learning models are being trained daily to detect malware and phishing attempts based on past data to thwart any new cyber attacks. These models can also be trained to identify any anomalies in any network. The anomalies may include erroneous traffic, a massive influx of traffic, or even a massive influx of traffic, or even more. Lastly, these advancements in AI and machine learning allow for previously written algorithms to be fine-tuned to allow for better defense systems. Whatever algorithms may have failed in the past can be tweaked using these methods to operate successfully in the future. As threats rise, the level of defense also rises. So in order to counteract the potential detrimental impacts of these technologies, we must use them in our favor. The cloud is becoming more popular. The cloud is becoming more popular than ever, with more people leaning towards storing their data on the cloud for ease of access. However, it is extremely important to note that there are problems that come alongside cloud storage. One of the main issues with cloud security is the potential of security misconfigurations. This happens to be the biggest. Whether it be due to a default flaw or a human error, security misconfigurations can leave all information vulnerable to hackers. Poor definitions of identity can also lead to unauthorized access of privileged information by cybercriminals. And lastly, leaving information stored on the cloud introduces a new realm of attacks, rather than storing data remotely. Data stored within the cloud could be prone to denial or distributed denial of service attacks, as well as zero-day attacks, which are exploits, which are attacks that have not been identified by current cloud computing defense software. Previously labeled cloud issues are all very much manageable. However, zero-day exploits cannot be accounted for, as those attacks refer to new attacks. For these type of attacks, we can do our best by implementing preventative controls to minimize the potentiality of these attacks. A more reliable way to solve a cloud security issue is by implementing two or multi-factor authentication, which essentially adds extra steps in the verification process to ensure the person accessing the data is indeed the person they claim to be. If a hacker does gain access to information through some means, it's important to make sure that the data remain useless to them, so we can implement various encryption methods to essentially render the data useless. Behavioral analytics is also on the rise due to the recent AI surge. BA, for short, analyzes human behavior to detect anomalies, which could be an indicator of new attacks. Lastly, logging all interactions with the cloud can allow for easy identifiability of a potential intruder. This, in combination with other defense mechanisms, can help stop a vast majority of cloud issues. However, it is important to note to never be complacent with a level of security within an organization, since the threats are on the rise and the defense should be as well. To dive deeper, behavioral analytics is another emerging technology which can aid users in defending against unwanted cyber threats. BA works in conjunction with artificial intelligence and machine learning in order to quickly identify, assess, and resolve any areas within the defense system that seem vulnerable. Hackers often approach attacks by targeting networks, and with the rise of BA, we can quickly identify which networks are being targeted and how they are being targeted to end the attack efficiently. Similarly, BA can also help identify geographic anomalies by flagging if there are multiple malicious attempts on a system from one location, which could end up being a group of hackers trying to gain access. Lastly, authentication flaws can often be detected by behavioral analytics by essentially alerting authorities if there are too many unsuccessful attempts when providing login credentials. Too many failed attempts could point to signs of a cyber attack, so BA would flag these attempts in a timely manner and help notify the proper authorities. IoT stands for Internet of Things. And to elaborate on my brief explanation earlier, the Internet of Things refers to the connection between physical devices, which can all communicate within the cloud and with each other. Each device has their own communication device inside it, which allows for ease of communication within the network. There are many security issues that arise alongside with the introduction of IoT, which include easily bypassed security, the spread of malware, and potential attack vectors if a system is compromised. More often than not, some devices have their own security measures, but lack comprehensive security for all their interconnected devices, which can be an avenue for hackers to infiltrate a system. Given the interconnectivity of devices within the Internet of Things, a hacker can easily spread malware from one device to another almost seamlessly, since the devices are already connected. Lastly, hackers can use the compromised device within the IoT as an attack vector to initiate an attack on an entire system. So clearly, IoT-specific defense mechanisms are needed. In order to best counteract IoT attacks, we can implement a series of defense mechanisms. The first defense mechanism is to secure access nodes. Everything within the Internet of Things is connected via access nodes, which allow the devices to communicate with one another. Hackers often try to exploit these connectivity nodes to gain access to the system. In the case of a successful breach, encrypting all sensitive information is another defense strategy one could employ when safeguarding the system. Thirdly, systemic audits to ensure that everything is operating as intended and there are no outlying security flaws can also minimize the possibility of a cyber attack. Lastly, we can employ zero trust architecture to prevent cyber attacks, which will be expanded upon the next slide. So what is zero trust architecture? Zero trust architecture is another type of emerging technology which operates on the principle of never trust and always verify. Essentially, all individuals and devices, regardless of how reputable or known, need to manually authenticate whenever accessing any resources within an organization. Although some may find this process tedious, zero trust architecture does help minimize a significant number of security attacks by making sure everyone who has access to privileged information is vetted accordingly. Zero trust architecture can help minimize inside and outside threats by requiring everyone to verify their credentials. It also operates on least privilege principle by only allowing authenticated users to access only the information they need to carry out their specific tasks. Lastly, implementing zero trust architecture within a system helps create segmentation within a web of devices, especially through IoT attacks, in which all devices are already interconnected with themselves and in the cloud. In order to properly address these new threats and the endless bounds of cyber attacks, we must adhere to certain regulations that keep the organization as well as its entire client base safe. Companies need to rely on their predefined cybersecurity regulations, which are more often than not defined by state and federal authorities to ensure proper safeguarding from cyber hackers. These regulations have just one goal, which is to safeguard the confidentiality, integrity, and availability of data, the three pillars. These regulations vary heavily based on countries, but they all aim to maintain national security. As new threats begin to arise with the new emerging technologies, it is pretty much imperative for organizations to abide by these regulations, if not exceed them. New threat vectors spawn day by day, so even implementing new company-wide regulations that can contour to unique issues can benefit the company greatly. New technologies in our society affect us both in positive and negative ways. The negative impacts from these technologies include the possibility of cloud and AI-based attacks. A lot of information is stored on the cloud. Whether it be personal photos or credit card information, cloud attacks are a main way in which hackers try to gain unauthorized access to privileged information. AI attacks are making hacking into any corporation relatively easy. They do this by using AI to fine-tune pre-made intrusion methods. Emerging technologies can also greatly benefit us by giving us a means in which AI and machine learning can monitor, identify, and defend against new threats. Using multiple emerging technologies in unison with each other can add layers to a successful defense, making it even harder for attackers to successfully compromise a system. Zero trust architecture is another methodology which is benefiting security standards as we know today. Behavioral analytics, when combined with AI and machine learning models, can automate the behavioral analytics process to instantaneously identify and report any anomalies within the system. And to recap, zero trust architecture is a security framework where everyone must be vetted appropriately. And especially today, where AI can essentially mimic the behavior of a fully functional human, zero trust architecture helps add another much needed layer of security in organizations. Here are my references, and thank you for listening.
That was great. Very cool.
Continuing the theme, we can create an artificial person to impersonate.
Well, that's what we need to get through the TSA, so...
Yeah, I'm still working on the skull mask so that we can okay. Trick the bioinformatics there.
Awesome. Jeez. It's getting too scary, I'm telling you. Oh, that was a good one, definitely. Okay. I hope I'm saying your name correct, Cece. Risk management framework, I think you're talking about.
Yeah, I was going to play the recording for him.
Okay.
He's working.
No problem. Go right ahead.
Okay, everybody can see that?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, wait, I don't have a shared computer sound on. One second.
Good evening, everyone. Okay. My name is Cease. And today I have a presentation called Risk Management Framework. And the motivation behind creating the presentation was due to seeing on the job boards, especially for SOC analysts, security analysts, system admins, to have risk management experience. So I decided to learn more about it, create a presentation. Hopefully you guys get something out of it. The outline of the presentation is to go over the history, the events that led to the development of RMF, what is it, all the steps that are involved in it, benefits of using risk management framework, the tools and technologies that are involved when creating the process, future trend of risk analysis. So history. So back in 2010, a significant shift occurred in the world of cybersecurity. The National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST, unveiled the risk management framework known as RMF. Not long after, the Department of Defense, the DoD, saw its immense value and integrated it to unify and enhance their risk management process across their information security sectors. Now, while it might sound like it's solely for federal use, it is not. Any business, large or small, looking to elevate their cybersecurity measures can leverage this framework. And in 2018, this RMF was fine-tuned even further. A clear six-step approach was introduced with the end goal being the authorization to operate, or ATO. ATO is basically the final seal of approval for systems to be activated within government or digital landscape. I think this is very, very clear and a concise way for organizations to go about in ensuring that the systems that they're trying to utilize is very secure. So let's get into what RMF is. What is RMF? So, risk management framework is a comprehensive strategy that blends security, privacy, and risk management from cyber suppliers right from the start of a system's creation. By using a method centered on assessing and managing risks, it determines the most effective and efficient safety measures while staying within the legal boundaries, suitable for both modern and legacy systems, diverse technologies like IoT devices or control systems, and business of all sizes and types. The RMF is essential for safeguarding information and ensuring privacy. So what are the six steps? We're gonna go over every one of it, of the risk management framework. So we're gonna cover the relevancy in security and privacy. So the step number one of risk management framework involves the identification and categorization of information systems within the organization. During this step, the organization assesses the systems that require protection and assigns them to a specific security category. These categories are determined based on the potential impact that a compromise of these systems could have on the organization. Step number two of the risk management framework. So then the organization goes through a process of carefully selecting a specific security control from NIST's special publication 800-53. This selection is based on the security category assigned to the information systems. The goal is to choose controls that are most suitable for safeguarding and protecting the systems from potential threats and risks. Step number three of the RMF. So the organization proceeds with the implementation of the selected security controls. This involves putting into action the necessary measures and procedures to ensure the effective deployment and integration of the controls within the information systems. The implementation process may involve configuring software, hardware, network devices, and other relevant components, as well as establishing appropriate policies, guidelines, and training programs to support the use and maintenance of the controls. By implementing these security controls, the organization strengthens its ability to safeguard the information systems and mitigate potential risks. Step number four of the risk management framework involves conducting an assessment of the implemented security controls. The organization evaluates the effectiveness of the controls to determine their ability to adequately protect the information systems. This assessment may include various techniques such as vulnerability scanning, penetration testing, security audits, and other evaluation methods to identify any vulnerabilities or weaknesses in the controls. The goal is to ensure that the implemented controls are functioning as intended and providing the necessary level of protection against potential threats and risks. Step number five of the risk management framework. So the organization grants authorization for the operation of the information system based on the outcomes of the security control assessment. This authorization signifies that the system has met the required security standards and is deemed acceptable to be put into active use. The decision to authorize the system considers the effectiveness of the implemented security controls and the overall risk posture of the organization. By authorizing the system, the organization acknowledges that it has reached an acceptable level of security and can proceed with its intended operations while ensuring protection against potential threats. And the last step, the organization undertakes ongoing monitoring of the security controls to ensure their continued effectiveness in safeguarding the information system. This process involves regular and systematic checks to verify that the controls are functioning as intended and providing the necessary level of protection. It also takes into account any changes that occur within the system or the threat landscape, as these may necessitate a reassessment of the security controls. By actively monitoring the controls, the organization can promptly identify and address any potential vulnerabilities or emerging risks, thereby maintaining a proactive approach to information system security. So, what are a few benefits of using the risk management framework? Proactive measures taken during the early stages of the system development lifecycle, or SDLC, enables organizations to identify and address vulnerabilities and risks. This early intervention not only helps in circumventing the escalated costs that come with remediation at later stages, but also streamlines the process. By judiciously prioritizing these risks, organizations can optimize their resource allocation, ensuring that their efforts and investments are directed towards the most pressing vulnerabilities or threats. Furthermore, This proactive and strategic approach signifies significantly reduces the likelihood of breach. In turn, organizations are better positioned to sidestep potential ramifications such as hefty fines, litigation, and the consequential reputational damage, which are typically associated with higher costs. So what are some of the tools that are involved in risk management framework? In the RMF process, risk identification and assessment utilized tools are Nessus or Qualys to scan and pinpoint system vulnerabilities. For risk response, RSA, ARCR, is employed to manage risks, ensure compliance, and automate processes. The mitigation stage leverages McAfee endpoint security, equipped with advanced machine learning defenses to protect against threats. Authorization or risk approval is streamlined by EMAS. EMAS is an integrated tool designed to streamline the risk management framework for information security as outlined by NIST. It efficiently manages the workflow of the assessment and authorization process, provides a centralized location for all required system documentation, aids in the selection and monitoring of security controls, and facilitates continuous risk management through its monitoring capabilities. And lastly, continuous monitoring and review are handled by Splunk or ElkStack, offering a comprehensive platform for analyzing machine-generated data and overseeing security events. So what are the future trends of risk analysis? The integration of AI and ML, machine learning, and risk analysis has revolutionized the way organizations approach potential threats. Leveraging vast amounts of data, AI and ML offer predictive analytics that enable organizations to anticipate future risks based on historical data, shifting from reactive to a proactive stance. So machine learning algorithms excel at automated risk identification by detecting patterns and anomalies that might elude human analysts, pinpointing subtle risk indicators. In cybersecurity, AI-powered real-time threat intelligence platforms can analyze data from diverse sources, offering a comprehensive view of the prevailing threat landscape and enhancing the efficiency of threat response. The concept of digital twins, which are digital replicas of physical systems or processes, permits organizations to simulate and assess risks under various conditions without any real-world consequences. And these are my references for constructing the presentation. I hope you all found the presentation informative. I learned a lot by doing a ton of research and constructing it. So I'm pretty sure the risk management framework, and like I didn't cover like all of it, this was just like an overview. If you enjoyed it, feel free to continue doing more research on it. And thank you guys.
Well, that was great. Very cool. We'll have to let him know that that was a very good presentation. It's always good to follow you, get your risk management together. Okay, who's next? If I can find the right date. Justin Rainey. Are you ready?
Yeah, I can be ready. All right. All right. Can you see?
Your screen is very small, so we only see partial.
Okay. Well, now
yeah, it's still only part of the screen. It's not like showing the whole screen.
All right. Sorry. I'll figure it out real quick. See, that's wrong. Sorry, one sec.
That is a full screen though.
Okay, yeah, I'm getting somewhere. Almost there. And not everything's here. All right, so I'll figure it out. Sorry.
No problem. Do you have the correct PowerPoint open?
I do now. Wait, it wouldn't go. It's in use. Let me close her down. Okay. How's that?
Yes, full screen. Awesome.
Okay. So sorry about that, guys. My computer went down today, and like I didn't even think this presentation was going to be here. I'm looking in the folder in SharePoint, and it's like my weekly AHOD must have somehow got saved over it. Anyways, thank God for versioning. So here it is. All right, my name is Justin Rainey. I actually have worked in medical imaging for the last 17 years, and so now I'm finishing up a cloud degree, and I thought I would just take a look back now that I know some IT things and analyze kind of what I've been working with this whole time. So data flow and medical imaging. Okay. Medical imaging is performed in several modalities, each optimal for diagnosing specific diseases or conditions. X-ray is great for seeing bones. It's right here. Fluoro is live X-ray, great for surgeons when they're in surgery and they have to see where they're going. CT is kind of the donut machine. It's best for soft tissue, bone, and for trauma imaging. And a little bit of neuro looking at brains. MRI, super high resolution, uses radio frequencies and magnetic fields to create high resolution imaging, especially of soft tissues, brain, spine, and joints. Ultrasound uses sound waves to visualize anatomy and acquire functional information, like flow velocity of blood vessels and whatnot. Nuclear medicine uses a special camera that can visualize radioactive pharmaceuticals that are injected into patients to determine cancerous or metabolic conditions. All of these modalities are generating a tremendous amount of data, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. How is it managed? Up until approximately the late 1990s, imaging output was stored on film, which was stored in files and was viewable on light boxes like we see on TV, like Dr. House is going to throw an X-ray up on a light box like it's 1992, you know. It was archaic, bulky, and inefficient. Patient files containing their entire imaging history had to be meticulously kept and manually retrieved for viewing by radiologists. Film was made and processed with harsh chemicals. But just like physical mail was replaced by email, a digital transformation was in order for medical imaging. Digital modalities such as CT and MRI were coming into relevance, but different vendors had their own proprietary data formats, syntaxes, etc. A standard was needed to allow communication and storage. In 1993, the American College of Radiology and NEMA released a digital standard for medical imaging that persists today. Digital Imaging and Communications in Medicine, DICOM. This falls under ISO 12052. DICOM supports a lot of different processes, specifically for imaging, commands to move, store, and retrieve data, the semantics of file services, file formats, and directories, network operation, message exchange, data dictionary. It uses some APIs. There's DICOM Web to transfer stuff over the internet. It uses REST architecture and RESTful interfaces, print services, data formatting, secure transfer. Is done. DICOM is usually going over port 104. It's called DICOM over TCP, typically. DICOM files contain a lot more data than just image pixel information. The additional data must persist with the study, and DICOM standardizes this process. So the image file is there, which can be pretty big. We'll get to that. But there are these other things that have to go along with those images. The structured report, the radiologist reads it, he speaks into some voice recognition software that kind of transcribes what they say into a report, and that kind of has to be turned into DICOM information, so that has to go along. A structure set, let's say somebody's getting like radiation therapy, they would actually go undergo a CT scan, and then the modality machine would kind of create some layered data on top of that for planning where to target radiation therapy. So that has to travel with the image data. A key object selection, the radiologist is reading. Sometimes they need to say, all right, this is an important image because one study may have hundreds of images. So this is a key one. So when they go back to that study, they can just look at the key images and know where the pathology is. The radiation modalities like X-ray and CAT scan that use radiation, per law, a radiation dose structured report has to be assigned to that study. And so DICOM encodes that report, and so it travels with the images. Digital imaging was given the technical means to communicate between multi-vendor devices through DICOM standardization, but there still needed to be a software layer to store, present, and manage images with their associated reports and metadata. Enter PACS, Picture Archival and Communications in Medicine. And this is kind of what we work out with mostly is our PACS system. PACS is a system made up of these DICOM-compliant components, imaging modality devices, so the scanners, X-ray, CT, all the big giant machines we run. The image archive, it's a PACS server, got to store it all somewhere. Diagnostic workstations that enable technologists and radiologists to manage the workflow. So we have to work with the images, we have to send them, maybe we have to send to another location, and we'll push the images, via a cloud to some remote reading radiologist somewhere. And then the connecting network is also part of the PACS system. PACS systems work with DICOM to fully digitalize radiology data and workflows, replacing film, plus allowed for user concurrency and error handling. Like other applications today, PACS can be configured on-premises in a hybrid setup or fully cloud-based. These systems are very customized for the adopting medical institution's needs. Most commonly, PACS handles all the imaging modality data. Many PACS can be deployed for specific modalities such as nuclear medicine, and they can offer additional specialized functionality. Large enterprises may even deploy a federated PACS, which can exist across many different sites. So we're seeing these ginormous hospital systems, and they have a PACS, and it's all interconnected, and it could span, you know, an entire region of the country. The storage network, direct attached storage, network attached storage, and a storage area network, it can be configured anyway. How much data are we talking here? Average hospital stacking up 50 petabytes of data per year. This equates to 137 terabytes per day. Medical imaging is responsible for 80% of all that clinical data. This is largely unstructured data because it's images for the most part. It's not easy to manage as structured data. There is a constant effort to normalize and classify it so that analytics might be useful for business cases. Here are some good examples of, you know, size of these studies. Just a regular chest x-ray is 15 megabytes, like an MRI, 151 megabytes. A breast tomo, those are pretty big, really high resolution mammography images, 450 megabytes. But then there's a new modality called digital pathology where they actually are imaging slides. And so they may have something that they found, a tumor or something like that, and they're digitizing that. And the resolution is so astronomical. It's like 3 gigabytes for one of these studies. And this stuff adds up. Here's just a PAC server, a little bit of hardware here. PAC server with 35 terabyte RAID archive and high-speed fiber. Pretty cool. That's probably pretty small, really. PAC has reigned supreme as the go-to medical imaging jack-of-all functionality, but things are changing. Enter the vendor-neutral archive. So, you know, that's not enough, the imaging information. There's a bunch of other different things that people are getting now. They're going and having an endoscopy. That's an outpatient thing where they go down the throat with a scope. Well, there's like physical picture images associated with that. If somebody has a bad wound, they'll take pictures at first, and they'll come back every week, and they'll take more pictures, and they'll compare those pictures and say, okay, this thing's healing up pretty good. All of that stuff has to be kept now, too. Before, things were all separated into all these different systems, and if a doctor like wanted to get a kind of a big picture of their patients, they had to like log into 5 different sites. So this VNA kind of consolidates everything. They can store the DICOM data. I mean, mostly they're dealing with the imaging data, but they can also encapsulate data with different formats into DICOM for storage and cohesiveness of DICOM processes such as querying. This gives kind of a life cycle management as well. The VNA is a lot more flexible with the underlying database, and everything's changing. You want to switch to the cloud. Okay, well, it's a lot more flexible now. Updates and corrections are easy to do. PACs always had to be migrated before. Most companies every 5 to 7 years might have to switch to a new vendor, or they were updating all their software. Well, this data just always was getting moved around and stuff like that. With the VNAs, everything's kind of stabilized and there's no more migrations, a lot safer. Physicians, kind of like I was saying, physicians can treat patients better because all the data associated with the patient's many distributed workups is all consolidated in one place. It used to be very difficult to see the big picture when to do so may have required logging into several systems. Analytics can be employed on the patient data since it's all in one place and in a standard format in a VNA. And it's also cheaper. All the data is consolidated in one place. So you're managing it in one place instead of managing those extra systems too. Now that we understand what's happening in the medical imaging, it's important to understand how it connects to the rest of the hospital. Imaging is but one aspect of patient care, and the overarching information technology system is the electronic medical record. Cerner's one, Epic is a real big one you might have heard of. There's a few more. They're pretty big platforms. The electronic medical record is the main hub that all hospital departments managing patient care work through. So the nurses are working through this. The respiratory therapists, the doctors are in here putting the orders into this. The medical imaging component of the EMRs is called RIS, the Radiology Information System. That's kind of its subcomponent. Communication between the EMR subcomponents is done via a standard called Health Level 7. So DICOM is very specific to radiology. Everybody else, all the other systems in the hospital use HL7. It was developed for the same reason DICOM was, so these kind of disparate systems can work together as everything has become digitalized over the last 10 years or so, especially with the government push, I don't know, 4, 5, 8 years ago. The 7 is a reference to the application layer in the OSI model, where most of these transmissions occur over HTTP, secure file transfer protocol. File transfer protocol secure can be used to securely send these transmissions. HLS7 has had several revisions. The latest version is called FHIR, F-H-I-R, Fast Health Interoperability Resources, and is based on RESTful interfaces using APIs and open standard file formats such as XML. This is kind of an overview shot. Here's that health record, Epic, if you will. Within it is the health information system, which is almost the same thing. And then the kind of subcomponent, radiology's part. all of the information from all the scans comes into this area. It gets converted to DICOM, and then it goes into the PAC system. This kind of showed a little bit more of what's going on here. Like, there's an HL7 server, a DICOM server, a web server. So the PAC system kind of encompasses a whole lot of things, communicating and transferring DICOM to HL7 so that it can come back here, and then we can charge for it. So they've done the scan. We have to have a way to attach it to a billing component. And so that's how it comes back here and gets transferred back in HL7, yada, yada, yada. Kind of the same thing. Things are getting kind of stretched out here. Sorry. All right. A quick kind of workflow. The patient comes to the hospital. The doctor's like, all right, we're going to need to do an MRI. And then the patient comes here. The doctor's already put that order in here. So it's in HL7. It's in the health information system in the medical record. Now this radiology system subcomponent of that is like, all right, there's an active doctor's order. So what it does is it serves up a work list. When we go to the scanner, like, okay, it's time to do the MRI on this person. Now we have that patient is showing up here. And so that's being served from this. So we do the scan. That information gets converted to DICOM. And now it has a number associated with it so it can be tracked and be brought back to this system. Anyways, it goes to PACS. Let's see. And then the radiologist is going to want to read it. So that's what this is. It's being served now in the PAC server. It's DICOM information. The radiologist has a workstation that can view the DICOM and the images. He puts a report on it. The report goes back into this system and merges with the images that were already sent there. So now the images and the report are together in PACS. Final report goes down to here. So long story short, now that everything's in here, the radiologist has put a report on it, the images are there, everything is cohesive and in one place, the ordering doctors can read it on their workstation, and it can be burned onto DVDs and all that stuff if the patient needs a disc. The future, enterprise imaging is a broader framework being adopted by a large medical institution that incorporates all aspects of imaging and consolidates, indexes, manages, stores, distributes, views, exchanges, and analyzes imaging and multimedia content over for the EMR. So it's kind of like the VNA, but even bigger. It allows one enterprise to share large banks of data with other enterprises for training, research, AI, etc. Of course, cloud architectures are being incorporated wherever they possibly can be. If it's a good business case, it's saving money. AI, of course, it's in everything now. I could have done a whole, project on this. I kind of wanted to revisit the networking of it all, but AI is getting real exciting with medical imaging. They're using it to read x-rays, or using it to read mammos. And, this was kind of just like science fiction before. It's like, oh my God, are they going to replace the radiologists? But like with everything else, it's going to augment and hopefully not replace. There still will be a need for physicians to read these and look at these. I'm going to skip past that. Here is a cool a modern AWS spin on taking some patient information from the PACS with a dedicated line over to AWS. There's a couple services that they're running here with AWS to anonymize these images, take all the patient information off so that this whole thing is kosher with HIPAA. It comes over here, it strips all that patient data, and then they can run all these analytics, machine learning, run those services on it. They can glean a whole bunch of business data, it could be maybe when COVID came out, they want to know how many chest x-rays people got and how much that ramped up. Well, they can send all that information over here, use these really cool AWS services or wherever else you wanted to do cloud-based analytics. And then all that goes back over here to these machine learning models, I think, where like these researchers are accessing it through another service. So very cool. As medical imaging continues to evolve, the data demands will only increase. Imaging capabilities continually get more advanced, and that usually equals higher resolution, more advanced post-processing, and new technology. This is all added to the size of the files. How big are these archives going to be in 30 years? Thanks for listening. Any questions?
Great job. How long is How long is the data retained?
I'm pretty sure that legally it's 7 years.
Yeah, I thought seven. Okay.
But nobody's getting rid of it at all. I mean, that patient is still going to be alive. I mean, pretty much the only reason that you're going to purge any of that data is that they've passed away.
Right, right. This is all RRB related. Yeah, so is the data in raw form or is it compressed?
Oh, it's compressed. And I had looked up a whole bunch of info on the compression, and it's pretty crazy. What was that compression? Just looking at it. Anyways, I had a couple slides in there, but it was getting kind of lengthy. And the compression, it allows for faster transfers, more storage. You have irreversible and you have reversible.
Right.
And so you have to make those decisions on how you want to store it. Some of it's lost. It really depends on what kind of study it is. Like
lossy or lossless. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Like a MAMO, you don't want to lose any of it because resolution is king, looking for these little tiny, you know, tumors and whatnot. You don't want to miss anything. There's liability concerns. So anyways.
And I wanted to ask you about the slides being scanned. How many field of views is that actually talking about?
I don't know. Are they doing, how many slides are they doing? You know, are they flipping through it like a
cat scan? Right. Obviously, at 3 gigabytes, they're doing multiple fields of view.
Yeah, and I forget, I had read a long time ago about what the resolutions were. I mean, it's just like blowing any other resolution out of the water because they need the detail for...
Because I was wondering if they're like stitching, because as a histologist, I would look at a large tissue sample, and that gives me the structure so I can interpret what's going on.
Oh, cool. You're a histologist, huh? So
I have many degrees, so...
Wow, cool. Yeah, you might have to work with this someday.
I already do this, but I'm an end user. I don't do the acquisition. I work on the end product.
Awesome.
Excellent job. This is really good. A lot of information. Definitely. It's good to know. Nice. All right. Next up. Rodney, are you ready? I see your mic is up.
Yeah, are you double muted, Rodney?
Your mic is on this end.
He might be talking to a mic. Hopefully he can hear us.
Right.
Can y'all hear me now?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. My apologies. I was trying to ask if I could have like 10 more minutes. I'm just about to kind of like send things over, and I was just kind of touching up like a couple things. Is that okay? Can I do that? If not, just give me like 2 minutes and I'll try to rush really quickly.
I can show the one from my I have a recording to show for Robert Murdoch. I can show in the meantime, and then you can do yours after his.
Yes, sounds perfect. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
All right. Let's do that.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you. Okay.
My mind, open that up. All right. Okay, can everyone see that?
Yes.
There we go.
Hello, everyone. My presentation centers around artificial intelligence and its potential to reshape our future landscape. Over the course of this presentation, we will explore the capabilities of AI and its responsible applications. Our primary goal is to differentiate between the realms of fiction and reality while examining the profound impact that AI is set to have on our world. Hello, everyone. So what exactly is artificial intelligence? Let's unravel the common misconceptions surrounding AI, many of which have been nurtured by Hollywood's creative depictions and nonfiction narratives. When you think about AI, you most likely are conjuring visions of a future dominated by all-powerful entities like Skynet, or self-aware, emotionally charged being reminiscent of Agent Smith from The Matrix. But how close are we to this fictitious reality where AI reads your thoughts, predicts the future, and poses an existential threat to humanity? The likelihood of this scenario is highly improbable, yet the fears and concerns people harbor are entirely valid. Incidents like the ones that took place at Facebook in 2017, where two AI chatbots developed their own shorthand language, have only exacerbated these anxieties. While the notion of AI possessing the autonomy to make complex moral decisions or initiating a catastrophic event makes for captivating storytelling, the reality of AI is that in its current state, it's distinct from its portrayal in various media. AI is meticulously designed to function within well-defined boundaries and programmed rules. It harnesses data and algorithms to make predictions and execute specific tasks. This means that, at present, AI lacks any semblance of consciousness, emotions, or self-awareness. It's more akin to a sophisticated calculator than a sentient being resembling Arnold Schwarzenegger. Building upon our comprehension of artificial intelligence, let's delve deeper into the core mechanics of AI. This exploration aims to illuminate the distinction between Hollywood's portrayals and the actual scientific underpinnings. Artificial intelligence is a multifaceted domain, and to grasp its intricacies, I'll attempt to simplify it into two foundational aspects: simulated intelligence versus programmed intelligence. It's essential to acknowledge that these aspects aren't entirely separate. They can sometimes intersect depending on the particular AI being created. Simulated intelligence serves as a focal point of numerous AI discussions. At its core, it relies on algorithms to process vast datasets through computational models. This empowers AI to identify intricate patterns and correlations, often surpassing human capacities, or at the very least, solving problems more rapidly and efficiently. Simulated intelligence operates based on predefined rules and patterns, meticulously designed to address specific tasks or issues. Machine learning plays a predominant role in this aspect, allowing AI to adapt and enhance its performance through accumulated experiences. Ultimately, AI's decisions stem from its analysis of provided data, reflecting its strong reliance on data-driven processes. In contrast, programmed intelligence represents another facet of AI. It is intentionally designed and programmed to execute specific functions, adhering strictly to the precise instructions and rules set by human creators. This form of AI performs tasks based on provided code without room for improvisation. Unlike simulated intelligence, programmed intelligence is generally non-adaptive and lacks the ability to learn or autonomously evolve. So as we continue our journey through the different dimensions of our artificial intelligence, it's important to remember that AI's decision-making process hinges on data, algorithms, and programming, which differs significantly from autonomous, sentient beings often depicted in fiction. Now let's pivot our focus towards how AI might impact society in the future. Now that we've discussed how artificial intelligence operates, let's shift our focus to its real-world impact on society. Understanding this impact is crucial because, like any new invention or technology, AI can have profound implications for communities and the workforce. As you've all probably gathered by now, AI has stirred significant concerns about job displacement. These concerns stem from AI's remarkable speed and precision in completing tasks, often outperforming their human counterparts. It excels at automating repetitive tasks, which has led to its initial impact in industries such as manufacturing, customer support, and data entry. However, many fear that AI might soon extend its reach into fields like automotive, finance, and education. While apprehensions about job displacement are entirely valid, it's equally essential to recognize the emergence of new employment opportunities. As AI continues to integrate into our world, it paves the way of new roles to open up in AI development, such as maintenance, supervision, and quality assurance. The education and training sector stands to benefit as well as AI transforms new learning methods. Imagine every student having their own personal AI dedicated to collecting and analyzing their data, tailoring their educational experience. Additionally, careers in sales, marketing, healthcare, and medicine will all evolve, with human expertise and intelligent automation working in tandem. In essence, our exploration of both fear and opportunity emphasizes that the future isn't solely about job displacement. It's about how we adapt and grow with this technology and how it enriches our lives. After exploring the fears and opportunity AI brings to the job market, let's now turn our attention to the positive transformations AI has in store for future employment. As we look ahead, AI is set to enhance job roles in several ways. First, it will augment our own skills, automating routine and time-consuming tasks, allowing everyone to focus on more strategic and creative aspects of their own work. Imagine, for example, doctors using AI to analyze vast medical data sets, providing them with instant insights to aid in diagnoses. AI also frees up creativity by taking on the repetitive and mundane tasks that most people do not enjoy doing, thus freeing up more of our time and mental energy. Think of writers, artists, or designers using AI tools to generate initial drafts or ideas, which can later be refined and improved upon. I myself use ChatGPT occasionally to review my own code or generate new ideas that I can then attempt to implement into existing code, allowing me to focus on refining a project or making it more creative. Moreover, AI will drastically reduce workloads by handling routine, data-driven tasks, allowing humans to focus on more complex, high-value activities. This is akin to an AI-driven personal assistant organizing schedules and managing administrative tasks, allowing executives to concentrate on strategic decisions. Lastly, AI offers the benefit of 24/7 availability. AI systems do not need to rest, unlike humans, and this means that they can provide continuous support, customer service, and even healthcare monitoring, ensuring that assistance is always within reach, no matter the hour. I think we can all relate to calling a number and being placed on hold for hours just to get a hold of somebody. What about productivity improvement, you say? I'm glad you asked, because AI's impact on jobs to go beyond just role enhancement, because it also boosts overall productivity. AI-driven data analysis supports decision-making by offering insights from large and complex data sets. Business leaders can utilize these insights for better-informed, data-driven decisions, leading to more efficient and profitable operations. Automation of repetitive tasks, another feature of AI, allows employees to allocate their time more effectively. For instance, in manufacturing, AI-powered robots can handle the repetitive assembly processes while workers concentrate on quality control and improving the overall processes. AI's ability to optimize process cannot be overlooked. In industries like logistics, supply chains, or transportation, AI ensures efficient route planning, inventory management, and demand forecasting, reducing waste and costs. Personalized customer service becomes a reality with AI because retail businesses now tailor their product recommendations to individual customer preferences. For example, e-commerce platforms use AI to suggest products based on past purchases and browsing history, enhancing the overall shopping experience. As we explore the positive impacts of AI on jobs, remember that AI isn't just about automation. It's about empowering humans, improving productivity, and providing unparalleled support and services. Now, let's dive into the ethical considerations surrounding AI as we recognize the importance of responsible development and regulation in this transformative era. After exploring the feedback, as we delve into ethical considerations surrounding AI, it's crucial to address the issues of biases embedded within algorithms. These biases encompass socioeconomic, confirmation, and selection biases, often rooted in the data that AI systems are trained on. Take, for example, a machine learning algorithm used in hiring. If historical hiring data includes biases, such as preferring male candidates, the AI may perpetuate this bias by favoring male applicants in its recommendations. This can lead to disproportionate impacts on different societal groups, reinforcing existing inequalities. Moreover, algorithms can contribute to the polarization of society. For instance, social media platforms use AI to curate content based on user preferences. This can inadvertently amplify extreme viewpoints, influencing the content we encounter and potentially hindering open dialogue and understanding. Privacy concerns also arise, as AI systems can manipulate and recommend influential content, affecting individuals' personal data and decision-making. Recognizing and addressing these biases are essential for building fair and responsible AI systems. The ethical implications of AI extend to its broader societal impact. Discrimination is a significant concern, as AI systems are increasingly involved in critical decisions, such as hiring, loan approvals, and criminal justice. For instance, an AI-powered hiring system may inadvertently favor younger applicants over older ones due to historical data. This raises questions about fairness and accountability in hiring practices. The security risks associated with AI, including cyber attacks and deep fakes, pose significant challenges to safeguarding privacy and the authenticity of information. Deep fake technology, for example, allows the creation of highly convincing fake videos or audio recordings, potentially leading to misinformation and mistrust. The potential for AI to exploit vulnerabilities in various systems and processes is an ongoing concern, with AI being used for cyber attacks to manipulate financial markets or disrupt critical infrastructure. Moreover, AI can lead to the loss of certain skills. For example, as automation continues to evolve, routine manual tasks may be handled by AI, reducing the need for specific manual skills and impacting the workforce. Environmental considerations are also paramount, as AI infrastructure demands substantial energy resources, contributing to carbon emissions. Lastly, privacy violations are a growing concern, with AI systems potentially infringing on individuals' personal information and data privacy. These ethical dilemmas underline the importance of developing and regulating AI in a responsible and transparent manner. After discussing AI societal impact, it's important to mention the transformative potential it holds. AI plays a pivotal role in various domains that directly affect our daily lives. In the realm of cybersecurity, AI's ability to analyze vast amounts of data in real time empowers organizations to detect and respond to cyber threats more effectively. For instance, AI-driven systems can now recognize unusual patterns of network traffic, helping prevent potential cyber attacks. In healthcare, AI aids in diagnostics and treatment recommendations by analyzing patient data and medical records. This can lead to more accurate and timely diagnoses, improving the patient outcomes. Additionally, AI is transforming education by personalizing learning experiences. Imagine a scenario where AI tailors coursework to individual student needs, providing adaptive learning materials and real-time feedback. However, these advancements also raise concerns about privacy and data breaches, which AI developers and regulators must address. AI is not just reshaping individual societies. It's also playing a vital role in addressing global challenges. For instance, AI-driven language translation facilitates global communication, breaking down language barriers and fostering international cooperation. AI is also a potent tool in climate change mitigation as it can process vast climate data sets to model and predict changes, aiding in sustainable resource management and reducing greenhouse gas emissions. In public health and disaster management, AI enables early detection and response to disease outbreaks and natural disasters. For example, AI-driven predictive models can anticipate disease spread and assist in disaster response coordination. However, there's an ongoing debate about job displacement due to AI's automation of routine tasks, which necessitates the responsible management of AI's impact on the workforce. As we explore these societal and global dimensions of AI, it's evident that while AI offers remarkable solutions, it also poses significant challenges that require thoughtful consideration and action. Transitioning from our discussion of AI's ethical considerations, understanding its societal impact and global contributions underscores the importance of responsible AI development. By addressing privacy concerns, enhancing education and healthcare, and tackling global challenges, we can harness AI's potential for positive change while mitigating its risks. Now let's turn our attention to the future of an AI-driven world. After discussing AI, as we peer into the future, it's clear that AI is set to revolutionize healthcare. AI-driven early disease detection systems have the potential to transform medical diagnoses. Imagine an AI tool that can analyze subtle changes in medical imaging, leading to earlier detection of diseases like cancer. AI is also poised to revolutionize medicine discovery by rapidly processing vast datasets to identify potential drug candidates. This can significantly accelerate drug development, potentially leading to breakthroughs in treating various conditions. In the realm of mental health, AI-powered assessment tools and chatbots are emerging, providing real-time support and resources for those in need. For example, chatbots can offer immediate responses to individuals experiencing emotional distress. Furthermore, human augmentation, where AI collaborates with human abilities, holds the promise of enhancing our cognitive and physical capabilities, fostering a future where AI assists in complex problem solving and physical tasks. In the environmental sphere, AI offers innovative solutions for a sustainable future. Safer transportation through autonomous vehicles is one such example. AI-driven self-driving cars can significantly reduce accidents by making real-time decisions based on sensor data. Additionally, the concept of smart cities, where AI optimizes urban infrastructure, holds immense promise. Imagine AI systems that manage traffic flow, energy usage, and waste disposal, creating more efficient and sustainable urban environments. AI also plays a vital role in agriculture and energy transition. AI-driven agriculture technologies can optimize crop management and resource usage, contributing to increased yields and reducing environmental impacts. Transitioning to renewable energy sources is facilitated by AI, which can predict energy demand, optimize grid operations, and harness clean energy more effectively. In space exploration, AI assists in analyzing vast astronomical datasets, uncovering celestial mysteries and supporting missions to new frontiers. This illustrates the profound impact AI will have on our future as it shapes healthcare and fosters eco-friendly innovations that are important for a sustainable world. Building upon our discussion of AI's role in addressing global challenges, the future is undoubtedly an AI-driven world with healthcare advancements and eco-friendly innovations at its forefront.
Are we done?
I didn't hear any conclusion or anything.
Yeah. Is
there one more slide left in the deck?
I thought I clicked it.
As we peer into the future.
Oh.
There we go. Takeaway.
There it is.
It is not clicking. Okay, there we go.
In closing, our exploration of the AI landscape unveils a future filled with immense promise. While concerns about job displacement are valid, the overarching impact of AI is undeniably positive. We've witnessed how AI empowers positive transformations across various sectors, enhancing efficiency, productivity, and fostering innovation. It plays a crucial role in addressing global challenges, fostering international collaboration, and supporting solutions for a sustainable future. Yet, as AI continues to reshape our world, we must remain steadfast in upholding ethics, fairness, transparency, and accountability in its development and application. To navigate this AI-driven world responsibly, staying informed, engaging in ethical discussions, and actively shaping its use is essential. For example, in the realm of healthcare, AI-driven diagnostics are revolutionizing the early detection of diseases, potentially saving countless lives. In the global context, AI is facilitating international cooperation through language translation and climate change mitigation. This illustrates the potential to address critical challenges. Moreover, ethical considerations are not limited to AI development, but extend to its everyday usage, ensuring the privacy and fairness are upheld. In this era of transformation, let's proactively embrace the opportunities presented by AI while also taking deliberate steps to guide its development towards a more promising, interconnected, and ethical future.
Okay.
That is a perfect compliment, and that's compliment with an E, not an I, to our earlier discussion, because what he's talking about is mostly machine learning. Yes. And have you argued with ChatGPT lately? Especially when it misquotes your publication that you wrote yourself?
Oh, wow. Okay.
It will not adjust. It is a damn it. That's the algorithm. It's going to insist on it. I'm like, you're wrong. I wrote that damn paper.
It's bound to happen, right? You get too smart. Oh, let's see. I just about AI tonight. Everybody want to do AI tonight.
I won't be doing the AI.
Oh, good.
I won't be doing AI.
It's a trendy thing.
Yeah. It is.
I'm actually probably going to dip a whole curve on you all, but I hope you like it though. Yeah, I'm going to kind of steer all the way to the left. It's going to be a bit different.
All right.
Great.
Go right ahead.
Oh wow! Don't put me on the spot. No worries though, right?
Right.
All right, so you want to screen share and I bring up my screen? Do I need to kind of get you over a copy? Because I literally like just finished like 10 minutes ago.
You can share your
screen share. Okay, all right, yeah. No worries here. Okay, so I'll screen share. I'll be nervous until I start sharing my screen and I will gain confidence at that point from somewhere.
You are going to dominate here. Just
thank you much. I really, he gave me that. I feel like it now. I have a tiger. I'm there. Let's do it. Okay. So I think I should share my window, perhaps, in my master class presentation. And if you all can see that and we are great, I'm going to start the slideshow now. Are we?
I already like it.
All right. Awesome.
Yeah.
Okay. So what madness may I possibly have in store for you all? I really want it to be intricate and be as descriptive as I possibly can. So I chose something I am passionate about, which is martial arts. And I try to make a project management charter off of how to technologically advance this. It's as old as anything we know, but how to make it make sense in this current situation that we're in with technology and smartphones and tablets. Well, I'll detail for you. All right, let's get started. So the first thing that I've deduced in this journey of mine to technologically advance martial arts is, like, what do I need to do it? How can I change it? And how can I make it different from the current structure we know? I've noticed a trend on YouTube and TikTok and every other facet of social media that we have. And that thing is that people love the help yourself and do it yourself trend. And video learning is really huge. But what if we push the envelope a bit further, and instead of them watching pre-recorded videos, they are now interacting directly with a competent instructor that can detail the advances they need to make, critique their errors, and let them know how to achieve that level of success. At least it makes sense to me. Another addition to this particular project is the engaging of martial arts choreography. And if you take a moment and indulge and just kind of go to YouTube or TikTok or any other outlet and type in fighting choreography or martial arts choreography, you will be met with hundreds and thousands of people who just have a passion for martial arts. And those are the ones that this particular platform will be developed for. I'll continue a little further. And so now I get to the point as to, I'm like, okay, Rodney, what do you need to do in order to make this significant? And I was like, initially, we'll use Zoom. Then I thought about, if we use Zoom, I will make Zoom millions of dollars. It would be much more beneficial to develop a software team and let them develop the applications that I need. And that way we can keep everything in-house in that regard, and we won't have to outsource millions of our earnings to the platform of anyone. Our functionality will be able to accommodate various platforms such as iOS, Android, Windows, macOS, and we want to be able to reach all of those. As you notice, sometimes something will be for Windows, but it won't support Mac. We want to support everyone. We want every student to have a chance to indulge in this platform and learn collectively. Additional features is now my next game. Like, what else needs to be there? Well, of course, we need payment features. We need our students and instructors to be able to select classes. And this is the beautiful part. We have no contact classes. You're probably like, what is a no contact class? Well, if you kind of think about the madness, but it makes sense. When the pandemic hit us, we were kind of left with the dynamic. It's like, how do we physically fill voids when people aren't physically there? The maneuver was to, hey, let's virtualize them. I agree. I think we should. I think we're capable. I think people are. And that is what no contact classes are about. It's about virtualizing that interaction and connecting our students with their instructor. And we can do this technology-wise based on region, language. We can make everything come together. We just need to apply the right parameters of technology. But everything is there to make this possible. Right. So then we transition from the no contact classes over to the facility, which will actually be a physical location that will be another means of gaining people into the platform, into what we have to convey, as well as another means to gain finance. The facility will not only be a place to say, hey, you can come here to train if you're in the area. We will also be able to rent out space to local instructors and maybe even some martial arts dojos, as well as individual martial artists who may need somewhere to train but don't want to commit to a discipline. That is the beauty of this image. It is based on what martial arts was founded on. Before there were ever distinct disciplines, it was you were a martial artist or you weren't. You trained together collectively. You traded tips, techniques, and that is the foundation of martial arts. And that's what this is about. We're getting back to that form of return of honor, so to speak. All right, but transition forward a little bit. Then we got to the portion of the website. And I'm saying, okay, well, I need to engage this, but how to make it still have the same flair is everything else. I have been trained in several different martial arts, from karate to taekwondo. But right now, as I'm about 40 years old, I don't want to do a lot of jumping and kicking. I find myself comfortable in swordsmanship. Japanese swordsmanship to be particular. So right now I train in Yaito, Kenjutsu, Bato Jutsu to help hone my mind and give me back discipline I may have lost along my way to give me a core foundation and help get me in tune with the things that are relevant to me. One of the beautiful things about martial arts and one of the things that are most commonly overlooked in today's space. However, that's what this is about. And the beautiful thing, again, about Japanese swordsmanship in particular. And I transition from there to, well, what's another facet that we need? If you want to be popular and relevant in anything with today's age, you have to be trending. In order for you to trend, you need to have a means to trend. This is now commonly done from videos, and it used to be picture submissions, but it's a thousand words difference between a picture and a video. So we will most certainly build our platform as we transition to our 1 year anniversary to kind of build up this excitement around this platform and get people to understand that if you are a martial artist, if you indulge, if you have that passion, it will make much more sense for you to commit to our platform than anyone else, because ultimately we are here for you. Martial arts philosophy. This is something that I really don't see a lot of now in today's martial arts. People very rarely have moments that Bruce Lee had when he made an iconic statement and said, be water, my friends. Sometimes people don't understand the gumption of the statement. To be water means to be transitional. It means you can be as gentle as anything, or you can be as firm as a brick. It depends on how hard you want to fall on it. If you can't brace yourself for the impact, you will plummet into cement. But if you can wield and bend to the wind on your way down, you'll find yourself landing in something that will embrace you on the way down. It depends on how you want to bend to its will, right? So I'll transition a little bit, but I'll pick up right here at the payment system, because if we do all of this, we have to have a means to get paid. We can't have all these developers and all these different aspects if we have no means to make money and we have to charge them. So the payment system will be implemented in. It'll be very specific details about how it will function. Any refund policy or anything that we have will also be stated within that particular payment page, just to let the guests know what they will be aware of, the expectations, so to speak. Now, one thing that I am very big on is not coming with a half cooked plan, but having an entire plan from a bird's eye view perspective. And what I see when I look at this project, I see the potential to brush in hard, be very aggressive. We'll take 4 months, and instead of taking one full calendar year to develop a software program, we will take a very short route initially. We'll take 4 months to produce a very firm and strong, stable, minimal beta. People are probably like, well, Rodney, why are you going to present a beta? And I will counter with, well, lately, as you're looking at video games and other things, who really hasn't presented a beta? You'll present a beta to give you a chance to run metrics, collect data, and understand the next progression you need to take if you have several different outlooks. For me and our team at this point, we have a collective outlook. We will transition the minimal system that we have at initial launch into a full-fledged social media outlet at 1 year. It'll take some time. It'll take some growth. But if you give me a few moments, I'll get into those details for you as well. All right. But I'll just kind of continue with the rest of this page. But the future planning is totally significant. We have a member section with access to video tutorials that will be kind of based on the style and discipline they take, and the instructor, and the region, and the language. There will be a member registration section, as well as an instructor registration section, which are very important because the platform can't exist without either. We need them both. All right, so I'll go forward a little bit. Now, database. Now, I was initially thinking about this, and I was like, I play video games, and me personally, I can blow through a few hundred gigabytes of data in like a week. If that's me individually, and anyone who may be more obsessive with retaining things as I am, we need a lot of data. So when I was initially going through this breakdown process, I was doing everything and was like, we'll base it around hardware and equipping the actual networking facility with inside the dojo that we'll establish. And we got into the pricing, and then the sponsor was like, well, that may be too expensive. Can we do something cheaper? Something to where we don't have to engage it so much. So in response, I came up with the AWS solution that actually saved us a lot of money. We don't have to spend as much engaging. It lets us pocket more money, spend more money fully developing our online store, as well as other engagements like equipment for the actual physical facility, installing access control points for security, surveillance camera, being able to get physical security for that location because it is very important to our success as an entity, right? But I'll continue a bit further. So now we get to the desktop application, and I'll kind of traverse a bit faster. So the desktop and the mobile version will almost share the same thing. And when we first came into development for this, we were going to have two separate teams. However, if we have two separate teams, the potential for a failure is much greater. Instead, we will condense this to one software development team that will develop both the desktop and the mobile application, and they will work in conjunction with our website development team to make sure all the integrations are point in, nothing is out of place, and everything talks to each other like it should. All right, now, again, just to kind of give a dynamic, right? As I'm going through AWS and pricing storage systems, I'm kind of doing data. And the number that I kind of came up with here is that a lot of things with AWS are kind of based on what you use. So if we use, my friends here, 20,000 terabytes, right? That's a crazy number. Like I personally have like 7 terabytes on my PC, but 20,000 terabytes is insane. But the users, the usage, and if you hear my like endpoint projections of where we should be user-wise in 6 months, it'll blow your lid. However, we needed something to accommodate this. So we kind of have a gumption right now to be understanding what we need, but we're fully capable, when you look at our budget, to be able to afford 20,000 terabytes now, if need be, just for clarity, right? But I'll transition just a bit further here. We'll get into social media. Because again, as I stated before, if you want to be important, you have to trend. And we can try to trend through YouTube or TikTok, but after we've already gone for the pizzazz of wanting to develop our own system for video chat, why not develop our own system to trend? It seems crazy if we would not. So we'll traverse past that, and we'll get into our social media management that will manage all of the different media media additions that we will get. Videos, the pictures as well, they can be attached. However, we need to maintain a very positive image. Martial arts has been tainted by so long for so much, whether it's lack of discipline, too much finance, a colored belt system. I won't get started there. We're just trying to traverse past that. But as we dive deeper into this, we will understand the whole purpose is to get back to that ultimate essence of martial arts, which is why the platform will be named Return of Honor. Not saying anyone who hasn't thus far is dishonorable, but if you take part in, you will understand the reason of the term. I'll transition just a little bit further as I'm trying to kind of move along here. Now, just before I get to the networking, we do have plans for a online store, as well as selling additions inside the facility as well. This will be done by conveying partnerships for the network. I'll get into detail about that in a few moments. However, there are several sellers personally that I have relationships with, as well as other people involved in the project. And to be able to convey to them what it would cost for us to buy items in bulk, we have come to the conclusion that it will save us phenomenal money. One of the problems that you'll see when you indulge in a lot of foreign martial arts in the US is a lot of times you have to have things imported in, which cost additional money, What if we gave you a platform to where you could train with us and we could supply those additions for you, half the cost in a much quicker time? Would you buy? It's rhetorical, no worries. So I'll move forward a little bit more. All right, so then we get to the networking aspect. And so how does this work? How can we make this madness connect? Okay, to be simple and just kind of lay it out in layman's terms, we need everything to be able to talk together. So we will look at this in terms of like a language. So right now, instead of like Spanish or French, they're speaking PC. So if we have things speaking PC and they understand PC, they can talk together. Again, we will be utilizing the AWS system in conjunction with different applications. I'll get into specifics here in a moment. However, through their API selections, especially for the applications, we'll be able to connect everything back into our applications to make sure data gets triggered and reciprocated to the proper destination, which is of ultimate importance, because if we can't save anything, why are we even doing this? Right. But that's important. Passwords, they will need to be managed specifically because, as we all know, the best way to compromise something is for it to have a weak password system. And we're only as strong as we are weak. Martial arts term. But we'll make it make sense in a moment. So now we get back into like the required teams. Like, how do we get all of these people together? Well, we'll have a website development team. It will consist of analyst, a back-end developer, front-end developer, architect, UX designer, graphical designer, and a quality tester. Now, to kind of cut this short, I, Rodney, have quite an extensive skill set. A lot of these tasks that I kind of see on these things that I go through, some of these I can individually handle on multiple fronts. And so when we look at this, instead of thinking in terms of, wow, we need like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 people, or we need 3 skill people that can wear multiple hats to complete the same task. It's about how you view it. Is the glass half full or is it not there? I don't see glass. I just see opportunity. My dynamic. I've transitioned a bit past, and now we're looking at like the mobile application. These things will consist of like the product owner, business analyst, developers, and UI UX designer, QA engineer. But as I kind of stated earlier, we came to the conclusion, instead of having 6 teams, it would be more conducive to have 5 and kind of strategically plan out that manpower to make it make sense to our structure and still stay within budget and be able to deliver the beta in 4 months, which is key. All right, so I'll transition down. We'll go through desktop application, kind of essential to the other things. It's multiple individuals that you would need to convey this. We have broken things down to people having multiple skill sets and being able to do this and are actually thrilled about taking part in this particular project. People would not think that I am a ex-law enforcement officer that just so happens to develop, that just so happens to be in the martial arts, that just so happens to love music. I'm not the only person. And these multifaceted people with multiple talents are ones that we're looking for, and you will be surprised at who reach out to us just off the excitement of taking part in something like this, because as of yet it hasn't been done. So I'll traverse a bit forward as well here. Now we're looking at the database and the teams that we need to complete this. Of course, product manager, data analyst, data scientist, data engineer, machine learning engineers. We kind of talked about like AI, we won't go there. And the cyber reliability engineers, and all of these things, networking, shaper, implementer. What does all this mean? All this means is, if you look at it and take it at face value, you need 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You need all these people to convey this job. And in reality, you do not. You need competent individuals who are experienced and fired up about what they do. And if you can connect with them, or if you can connect with somebody who's on the boundary and get them to understand and accept and love, then what you just gained is another train on the track. It's another piston in the engine. It's another wing on a plane. It's another horsepower to it. It'll make it go. But can you make them understand your madness? Now we'll get into how everything connects back into the facility, which is like the ultimate point. I have no idea how long I've been talking. I think I may be getting close to the end. My apologies, but let's see if I can indulge a few more moments. The beautiful thing about the facility is the status that it will hold, is what it will represent to people who are familiar with martial arts. And I don't mean maybe your casual 12-year-old or 15-year-old. I mean your 45, 50-year-old who has been a diehard martial arts fan since their very first episode of Ninja Turtles, or someone who may be 36 or 37 and is diehard fan from the first time they watched Power Rangers. These are the spots that martial arts hold with people. And it's still something that's heavily indoctrinated into our culture. It's something that is displayed everywhere, still in movies, TVs, cartoons. This is something that won't go away. And as we get to a point, we'll realize, like, why hasn't it bloomed the way it should? Because nobody took the time. But I will. So we get back again to the facility. We will use it on multiple fronts. It will be a store to sell merchandise so guests can come in and buy things they can't buy anywhere else. It'll have multiple fronts so it can be used to rent out space so that people can come train, whether that be an instructor or a group of people who practice in something like Japanese swordsmanship or any other martial art that requires a weapon. Since I train with a sword, I know how hard it is to train in my house. Like, I got scrapes on my ceiling. My wife would probably like kill me if she knows I'm trying to hide them. Different story. However, to have somewhere to go so you don't have to spend money to repair your roof, this would provide that. It would give you that comfort that you need to be able to go in, train, be efficient, enhance your skill, humble yourself, be disciplined, and not destroy your stuff and make your wife mad in the process. It's a win-win for me. Now, as we kind of break those down, and if you kind of go back over a lot of the information I've presented, a lot of things here are about nobility, about honor, and about finance. And I don't think you can cut it any way in any country, in any religion, or any space to where things don't go hand in hand that way. Now, I'm not saying everything is about money, but I'm do saying you may want to have a certain amount of it to be comfortable, or if not, you can be like the most extreme minimalist. And I love those people because they kind of make me want to do more to try to feel like I don't have to have as much to survive. I'm not quite there yet. I'm working on it. Right. So you look at all these different fronts and different outlets and all the ways to make money. And then you're like, okay, so Rodney, you're a project manager. You have all these people. Like, how are you going to make this work? I'm not going to lie. I'm going to make it work through technology. We will have a messaging system as to where information can reciprocate from our sponsor. They'll relay over to our review group. In terms, will relay over to me. And again, with my background from working in law enforcement, I worked with the Fugitive Task Force team for about 4 years. I did traffic control for about 3 years after leaving. I'm not going to say I'm a control freak. However, I don't like for things to be in disarray. Take it how you will. So for me to have a plan to mitigate this before it becomes a problem is everything. So if you kind of look at my kind of coordinated madness, it'll kind of make sense. Once the information is funneled through me, because at the end of the day, I totally understand and will uphold the integrity and the vision that has been established by the sponsor, which in this case would be my particular sensei, Nobu Hatsukai of the Asayama Ikedenuha. Totally different thing. We'll get to that in a moment. But you look down and you kind of break down and you see I have this labeled in different sections. So we'll have our database development team. It will consist of 3 members, one being a team lead. And all these boxes will convey the lead as well as the team member. And you're like, well, Rodney, I was looking on that list and they said you needed like 7 people for that. If we're dealing with newbies, but if you're dealing with an individual that is fired up and loving what they do and they're good at it, asking them to create a website and then you check over it as you go is not really a difficult task. It may be a bit much to ask, but can you make it sound sweet? I think I can. We'll kind of traverse forward and go forward a bit more here. So still kind of going on an organizational chart. And now it's just like on the approach. How do I plan to gauge everything? Well, from the initiation, we plan to design a few things up the database, network, software application. If you notice, we kind of went away from the mobile desktop deal altogether now. Social media layout. From there, we'll transition to the planning phase. This will detail all of the collective in and outs through the various system. This will also aid in the proper data being delivered to the proper destination so we won't have any issues, right? So if somebody tries to make a payment on account A and it goes to account B, we've dropped the ball, but we need to see better. However, as I transition, we get to the execution. And now that really kind of comes later in the project development process as you're kind of getting towards the end, and now things are kind of starting to mesh. Around this point would be critical, because as we get to the execution, it's almost done in like months. We have 4 months to deliver everything. By the time we get to the execution, now we're kind of in month three, maybe midway. So now we're kind of pressing the gas pedal, but don't want to go too fast because we don't want to crash. So we have the execution and a closure. This is around the time the database and things are closing out, but we still have about a week or work or so before the actual beta is delivered for the software. So this gives us some play. However, they are not coming from a total zero point, because we worked out a lot of details before the project started in conjunction with a development company, myself, Noble High Sakai, and a few other additionals to kind of have a rough draft. So we're not starting totally from scratch. We do have a blueprint, a roadmap, so to speak. All right. So we get to the closure, and by this time, if everything has gone to plan, and I would probably stress myself in this if it had not, but if it does, then we're looking pretty good to have a fully functional, stable beta version. And then in the terms of 1 year to date after that start, we'll be releasing the full social media platform. Different conversation. We'll kind of get into some of the details now as we kind of go over the different roles that it will take to contribute to this particular project. The sponsor will be Asayama Ikeden Yuha. That is the discipline that I personally trained under. Noble High Sakai, probably one of the most legendary martial arts masters in Japan. And I'm not exaggerating. I actually personally trained with Noble High Sakai. I'm a member of his Yuha, and I'm actually very skilled with the katana. Kind of transition down, and we have the Resolution Development Group that is based on me personally. I'm Rodney. I have been at Purdue University Global now for about 4 years. I started developing video games right after I started school here, and I legitimately started a resolution development group predominantly with video games, but as I have grown, so has it. So the Resolution Development Group will form the project review group and development team, make sure everything is going. I will be the project manager. Of course, my best friend, Artavis Watkins, a great guy. And if he can't make sure something is quality, I don't know anyone else who can. He's meticulous that way. He'll spend hours to make sure it's straight. Trust him. Procurement manager will be Shandor L. McCullum. A communications manager, Doris J. Dura, my grandmother. Hey, if she can't do it, no one can. And even though some things may be comical, however, I would not put these people there if I didn't think they could achieve success. All right, so as we kind of get back in, you're looking at stakeholders now. I would again be preferring the aspect of like the CEO in this particular event. I have a lot of invested in here. So I will make sure everything, of course, is in alignment with the original company vision. Barbara Spencer will make sure everything is on budget, and she will reciprocate all details back to Noble High Sakai. Ayana Durham will make sure everything is in accord with safety and health standards, because again, we will have to actually overhaul a facility and turn it into what we need. So we need to make sure we are in accordance with everything needed to have that go through without an issue. Be mindful, we're in the business of making money, not paying money. And if we can't do that successfully, if we can't add additions to a building and not be taxed, I don't know what we'll be doing. We should probably close, but we won't have that problem. We have Deborah Parks that will make sure we're in compliance with legislation. Again, as we will be doing things facility-wise, we need to make sure we are in accordance with all state and federal laws in the process of doing that. And that will be her job. Now, compliance with the best codes of practice may be something that may be taken lightly. However, it is very serious. It will make you much more efficient in your endeavors. And that will be April Watkins' job, to make sure she ensures that we are on the right path and doing things as they should. So I'll go back down, and now we'll kind of get into the budget. I may be running over. If I am, someone can stop me. My apologies. But as we get into, we'll see the various teams broken down, and here you will personally note the changes. We have our database software, of course, now software, not mobile and desktop, just software team. And you will see team member one, which will be the team lead, as well as the supporting cast that will come behind. Since I was constricted for time, I didn't get a better format. So you will see kind of half of this page going into some prices. I will transition to a next screen, and you will get the rest of the team members, and you will get their hourly totals for that entire department. All right, so we'll take the math and split it down there based on what they need to do for that timeline, and we'll start to get our totals. Now, this will let you know how long the departments will be working the hours they will collect and the total that it will equate to, as well as the total it will have on our project. Our starting budget was $375,000. After getting into everything and breaking it down, we came out to $327,000 and $327,720. My apologies, I may be tired. Now, we still have room to play, but we will utilize that particular additional funds to kind of set something up in the back in case we need to engage anything additional. But to do all of this and make all of this happen right now, that is the fee that we're looking at to be paid, $327,720. All right, so tradition pass. And this is the information in particular about the AWS solution, because as I was stating, we went with a hardware variant and it was pricey and they didn't like it. So they was like, hey, can we spend less money? And I was like, well, potentially we could, but how much do you want to do it? And they were like, well, we want to do it a lot. So we came with the AWS solution. And although it is fantastic, it will get to a certain point as to where we would much rather have a direct hand in maintaining that particular information and data. However, we figured for the first year, this makes perfect sense. So we will utilize the AWS system. And these are some of, the components that we will actually need to see that be successful. And we will use the Amazon Aurora. It's a relational database. Now, the prices can scale, but from where we digest, we could be looking at anywhere from $500 a month. And if it really upticks to its high point, we could be looking at as much as $5,000. However, if we kind of break down the finances and we say that the base membership that we'll have will be $50, the most expensive will be $200. We anticipate a $100,000 member mark in 1 year, and we won't even indulge the fact of the $200. We'll just say all $100,000 to $50. If we do, you'll get back a mind-boggling number of like $5 million. And you'd be like, that doesn't make sense. If you go back and see the whole dynamic and how we've been pushing this and speaking with people, they're waiting for this. This is what will push them forward. This will probably be what will have your 4, 5, 6, 7-year-old in the kitchen doing martial arts, screaming resolution development group. And you won't even know it. But this is how it starts, with a vision to be intense and aggressive about it and to have fun with it and to smile while you present it, because I've been cheesing this entire time. So we get to the Amazon app flow, and this particular will kind of help us transition information from the collective applications back over to where we need it to be, so all metrics and data can be collected so we can compile that information and decide ultimately what we need to take our social network platform in the direction of, which is very important and ultimately our primary goal at the end of all this. So as I go forward again, we have more information. We'll use Amazon GuardDuty, which is actually pretty awesome. If you kind of go read the details, we can use it as much as we need it, and the funds will be there to kind of make the proper payments and all of those great things. However, it could be as minimal as $50, and again, as much as like $5,000, depending on how it goes. Now, we will have a very small support staff on hand to deal with these things. But if anything major happens, this will be the entity that we will reach out to and let them properly mitigate it. And to do that, it will cost finance, but they are figured into the budget on a pretty large scale as well. So if we never use them, it's just more money that'll roll back to us, but they have been accounted for. And we kind of get into this as I'm kind of getting towards the end now, wrapping everything up. But this is just a chart to kind of detail like how much is actually going to go on, the different breaks for how much the departments will actually do. To be honest, the software department will ultimately bear the most load of the work, as they will be working the longest. But none of this can be achieved without every individual effort from every person and all the other departments collectively. So that is pretty much it. I have a lot of different references here. Some great information about where I got details from. I can also detail something in addition to, is that if we go back to 2012, we'll see the martial art industry was kind of bringing in around $4 million. So between 2012 and right before COVID hit, they transitioned from that $4 billion, right? Do the math. Just do the research and look it up yourself. So they went from like $4 billion. I still can't believe that, from $4 billion. And by the time they get to COVID and the pandemic hits and it declines, they're at almost like $9 billion, like 9.6, 9.8. So when the pandemic hits, it drops down to like a 8.2. And in 2022, it went back up to like an 8.8. I can't wait to see what the metrics and things will show for 2023. However, if you understand things and you indulge me for maybe 20 minutes, do a little research. Tell me if you can't come to the same conclusion. But I hope you all have liked the presentation that I put together. This is just my spin on what it would take to make this significant as it once was. So thank you. I appreciate it. Please tell me, y'all. Don't tell me you couldn't hear me, because that would be terrible.
We can hear you.
Oh, God. I was like, no. I was like, no, again.
And you know, Marjorie, what I'm going to ask, why do I not have Rodney? The guy thinks like me.
No. Listen, I had a lot of fun with this, but this is also something that I love to do. I'm actually talking. My katanas are sitting beside me. I have a few different ones. But I think things are as intricate as the fun you want to have with them. And this is something that people accepted and then they kind of dismissed, not off their personal engagements, but based off what people collectively said. But that's never been a practice of martial arts. It's not something you have to share with everyone. It's something you do for that self-balance, and that's the beauty of it. And that's what this is about, to give people back Rodney, to that return of honor.
Yeah. I'm 58 and I still do MMA.
Oh, I listen, I love to hear that. That's fantastic. How long have you been doing it?
Well, I did in college taekwondo and judo.
Oh, I love it.
And of course, in the Army, I did hand-to-hand combat.
Yeah, appreciate your service.
Army. I was an infantry officer.
And I appreciate you for it.
And then when I had my three sons, I enrolled them in Muay Thai and MMA. And because we had to do the family plan, because, well, I'm paying for it, I did it too.
That's beautiful. I actually also, and it's so many dynamics that I had to kind of cut short, but I have a whole scenario. I wrote a whole project charter and project proposal about this, actually, in vivid detail, probably like 32 pages now, but I actually have emphasis of a family edition. So let's just say if you have a membership and you're paying $150, every family member that you would add would be an additional $25, and they would have access to all the features you had. So when I first pitched this, they was like, you giving away. I said, am I mad or am I a genius? If I get you and your whole family, have I lost or have I won?
You won.
Exactly.
Because that without there's an inertia there.
It is.
Because that brings other families in.
They think it's a beautiful thing, and it really is. But if your wife and kids want to go, you'll pay so they can go just so they won't harass actually, you as a father.
My wife did, because they also offered self-defense courses for women. So she also got to enroll in that. So it was a great plan.
That is the absolute beautiful thing. That's why it's something, again, I've indulged in. I worked in law enforcement for years. I was an instructor, tactical, and self-defense-wise, I came up with various courses through weapon retention and self-defense as an officer, trying to keep someone from getting too close on your person. If they do, how to properly disengage them from trying to obtain your firearm, how to keep it where it needs to be, proper protocols, body language. Like, those are things that I did. And again, I've been a fan of this my whole life. I stopped law enforcement just to continue school, because when I tried to ask them about a promotion, do you know they told me if I went back to school and got a doctorate, I could make six figures with the police department? I was like, dude, if I go back to school and get a bachelor's, I can almost make six figures doing much of nothing. Like, what are you saying? So I kind of took a step back and then went back to school.
You need to come to analytics, because I can educate you on that. No, you don't need a doctorate.
Yeah, that's what I said. I thought they were insane. I'm going to actually send you a message. But at this point where I am, I went through most of my time here not really knowing what I want to do. I've had a lot of fun. I love developing video games. I code in Lua, C#, C++.
Python. You are talking about stuff that we are doing quantum teaming on. So it's not martial arts related, but you're talking about exactly the concepts we need to actually pursue.
I think. Well, I will most certainly message you. I am about to get finished, but I will be coming back as I will kind of start to work towards my master's. Not sure on what yet, but I love this university, man. I love this school. I've gone through a lot since I've been here, but I'm about to walk out the other side. So not to take any more time, but thank everyone so much. I hope you all like my presentation. And if you have the time, indulge in the martial art, man. It'll better you. Don't fight anybody, but just prepare. So,
well, I'm on hiatus because I got KO'd by a liver shot. So,
oh, you're not the only one. My best friend happened.
I know
he was sparring a 12-year-old and he got him with a roundhouse kick. And he didn't block it. I was like, why did you not block it? He said, I didn't want to hurt him. I was like, well, if you could go back, would you block it now? You didn't have to hurt him, but you could have stepped away.
It was a 30-year-old kid that hit me.
And you were thinking the same thing, like, yeah, I could block it, but I might hurt it. Yeah, he did the same thing. For me personally, I believe my best defense is to not be there, right? Like, if you try to hit me, I don't want to be there to absorb it. So my attention is to see you strike and me fade away because I don't want to absorb it. And then I'll attack after.
Yeah. All right. We're going to hand it back over to you, Marjorie.
Marjorie, thank you so much. You all are awesome. Thank you.
Did we put you to sleep, Marjorie? Oh, she's... You're there.
She gone?
She on the thing. But it says her mic is not... What do you think about all this, Charlene? This was actually a really great. We had all the scary stuff about AI.
I know.
And then we got to end on a positive note.
Which is good.
Sorry, I was actually messaging Marjorie because I thought someone wasn't able to show up. I was actually offering to present tonight just so they could get my spot next week if it would help with anything.
But hopefully Marjorie will respond to us. Or she got kicked out.
I don't know. Hard to say.
Jose Moreno? No. I was.
Who's next on the list?
I was First Lieutenant Moore.
I'm pretty sure Rodney was last. I think I was
He was supposed to be last.
Mm-hmm. And I think it was Eric who wasn't able to attend, if I'm
correct.
Right.
Correct.
Yeah, I sent him a message. I sent him a message earlier and still haven't gotten anything back from him.
Yeah, I was. I did message Marjorie and she said that I'd be willing to fill in so he could take my spot or they could take my spot next week. She said it sounds great, but just wanted to get a confirmation before I, start doing that.
Charlene, do you have her cell phone number?
I don't.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't either. I used to have Docs, but
that's
no longer useful.
I had Docs, too. Yeah, I've never got Marjorie's, so unfortunate.
So I don't know what's going on.
So did we finish the list or?
The list is finished other than the Eric who we haven't heard back from.
I see.
So I am of the opinion we call it a night.
Okay. Sounds good to me.
All right, everybody. I think this is great. This has been a great presentation. perfect for Halloween. All the scary stuff. We got on a positive note at the end, and we saw the perfect business plan. And we ended on a positive note.
I just personally want to say that I was so nervous about presenting, but I had an absolutely fantastic time. I was so nervous. I don't know if y'all could tell or not, but I was on pins and needles. But just thank you. I mean, I've learned a lot since I've been here, and I feel like I'm so much better going out than I was when I came in. So I really appreciate it.
I could tell. Oh, good, and good. If you want some feedback, I can give you some feedback on how to present.
I want feedback. It'll make
contact me, because I used to teach classes on presentations.
I'm putting my chair. I actually gave my presentation standing up. I couldn't sit. I gave the whole thing standing up. I couldn't sit. I feel like the energy wouldn't flow right. But I'm sending you a message right now, Landon. Anything additional that I can take shape with and make myself better as a presenter, I will greatly appreciate it. Even criticism, I take it creatively. I just want to be better. So thank you much for that.
The point of criticism is supposed to be creative. You're supposed to get better from it.
If you're smart, some people are not, but I appreciate it. It makes you better if you harness it the right way. All right. Well, I don't want to hold anyone else up. I am extremely long-winded. It's probably why I may be good at presenting. But again, thank you all so much. And you all have a great evening. All right. Be well. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, everybody. I think we're done.
I'm glad that you guys all came.
Marjorie gets back with us.
Yes, definitely. See you guys. Thanks for coming.
I'll hang here till the end, Charlene.
Oh, good. Okay. I'm going to go then. Good night.